everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I'd like to welcome you to the Progressive Commentary Hour. The theme today is one that is not normally discussed in any great depth by individuals in the mainstream media, and that is taking a look at a recent World Vaccine Congress that almost no one had heard about, except those who had something to gain from being there. Well, my guest has something to say about this and a lot of other topics on this very broad subject. Because why? We've just gone through over 3.5 years of being, in effect, indoctrinated into the idea that there is one truth, the official truth, and that all the information coming from that source, and that source has multiple outlets, the CDC, the U.S. Public Health Service, the media like the BBC, the New York Times, the Times of London, the Wall Street Journal, and virtually the entire business community, the pharmaceutical community within the business community, and different representatives that come forward, Dr. Lewinsky, and of course, the people who are sitting with the president, two different presidents, Trump and Biden, in the enclave of supposedly the ultimate knowledge on this condition, COVID. But how much of what they've told us, all of these sources, from the FDA to the President's National Advisory Board, how much of this is actually accurate? How much of it has been allowed to be challenged? How many scientists in the world, and there are many millions, how many were invited who are not normally a part of their inner groups to offer a different point of view? How many physicians were encouraged early on at the very beginning, treat a patient with whatever tools you have? For example, if you have FDA-approved off-label drugs like ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, monoclonal antibodies, steroids, azithromycin, or other antibiotics, because virtually all of the main symptoms of this new set of disease conditions had been manifest in different ways at different times, and doctors had seen it. Dr. C, the cancers, Dr. C, heart conditions. So why not allow them a chance to see, can I help this patient, at least with the symptoms I see? And they were told, no, you can't. Wait. In fact, wait and quarantine. Okay. Who should wait? Everyone should wait. What do you mean? We mean everyone is equally susceptible, from a young baby and a young child and a teenager and an Olympian and an older person, an old person with comorbidities. You should all be aware that you're equally susceptible to contracting this disease and dying and spreading it to other people. So the quarantine. Okay, a model of all this was done at a major university in Great Britain, and that model was used for the entire world. All right, was it accurate? No, at least partially accurate, completely inaccurate. Well, surely we would have stopped and recalibrated. No. Well, what was the answer? Vaccines and a particular drug. All right, well then the vaccines were the answer. Of course they were. But now we're looking back and saying, not so much. So we're at a place now where at least scientists from all over the world, physicians, nurses, people who are involved in the day-to-day effort to save lives in a very conscientious way, are speaking out. And they're publishing in peer-reviewed journals. And for the first time in the last 3 months, there have been hearings about COVID, and now under oath, where before none of this was allowed. You could have a group of scientists in, but they were not officially part of any hearing. They would be in a room by a senator, like a Senator Johnson, and you could have Dr. Pierre Corey and others, Dr. McCullough, Dr. Cole, etc. But none of this was officially accepted. None of this was in the congressional record. So the media didn't touch this. You didn't hear a report on it. To the contrary, Why would it be, for the first time in American history, that everyone who had a different point of view, no matter what the stellar reputation they had, no matter their credentials, no matter how insightful their decisions, no matter how positive their outcomes, they were all attacked. Not just one, every single one. Why? Well, that's what we're going to discuss with my guest. My guest is on the line now by Zoom, and we're going to talk about this. My guest is Madhava Sethi. Hope I pronounced your name correctly. He is a board-certified physician. He's a senior staff anesthesiologist at Lawrence General Hospital in the greater Boston area. He is also a senior science editor of Robert Kennedy Jr.'s Children's Health Defense publication, The Defender. He received an engineering degree from MIT and later worked for the aerospace and defense industries. This included a research expedition to the Arctic polar cap for the U.S. Naval Research. And dissatisfied with the nature and purpose of defense work, he went back to school to receive a medical degree from Baylor University College of Medicine and anesthesiology training at the University of Pennsylvania. He has over 20 years' experience in the field of anesthesiology, which involves dealing with the most challenging questions about the nature of mind and consciousness. He has been challenging, in his own way, modern medicine and neuroscience's fundamental assumptions about the meaning of awareness. He is the author of Woke, An Anesthesiologist's View, which explores whether we might be living in a dark age of unfounded beliefs rather than real knowledge. A culture unable to distinguish fact from fiction, and how we can better navigate the conflicting narratives that only give rise to more confusion and uncertainty rather than real solutions. His website, let me spell it for you, MADHAVASETTYMD.com. Nice to have you with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Gary. Thank you.
Early this month, the World Vaccine Congress was held, which brought together several thousand of predominantly staunch pro-vaccine scientists, researchers, and administrators from the pharmaceutical vaccine makers, federal health officials, and others. Literally, this is a who's who within the medical community who are the most belligerent, in my personal opinion, and intolerant towards vaccine critics. So you and a Dr. Mumper, also with Robert Kennedy's group, attended the three-day conference and had an opportunity to challenge these vaccine experts on various panels and have conversations with attendees. Some of the people who attended, we have noted in the past on this program, or have written about, such as Peter Hoetz and Gregory Polin. And based upon your write-up about the Congress that was published by the Children's Health Defense, it seems like much of the gathering had less to do with diving into the problems of vaccine efficacy and safety, and more to do with ways the pro-vaccine establishment can win over people who are vaccine hesitant and silence or censor vaccines' leading critics. And I assume the majority of the focus was on COVID-19 vaccines. So perhaps the best place to begin is for you to summarize for us your take-home analysis about the conference and its attendees. And then, after the conference, was there anything that you found especially bothersome? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Yes. So, Gary, thank you very much for the introduction. And you set up the conversation extremely well. I'm guessing that most of your audience understands that something very, very bizarre has happened in science, in government, in the media. And it can all be tied down to perhaps just a few things. And one of them that you mentioned was the fact that many credentialed physicians and scientists who are qualified to speak on these kinds of matters have been left out of the conversation from the very beginning. In any case, over the last 3 years, there has been a divergence of the independent voices of medicine and science and what we would call perhaps the medical establishment. And there has been very little interaction between the two. And this was an opportunity That was made possible by the donors and patrons of Children's Health Defense, who sent myself and Dr. Mumper to the World Vaccine Congress in Washington, D.C. during the first week of April. So I would have to say that it was an amazing experience, and I felt myself to be very privileged to be able to enter a world of what we, you know, for the last 3 years have been considering the lair of the enemy. And I found out some very, very interesting things. And just to hit probably the biggest point that I want to make now and at the end is it's important to understand what we're up against. Like, what is the mentality of these people? And very often in our side, which I would consider the vaccine cautionary sphere, if you will, or vaccine hesitant or anti-vax, anti-mRNA vaccine group, we tend to vilify the other side. And, you know, justifiably so, given how much tragedy has unfolded at their hands. But what I found was that the vast majority of people there, and most of them were not physicians that were treating patients, but they were scientists and people in the regulatory agencies, people who were working in biotech and all of the offshoots of the big pharma. Most of them were not psychopaths. You know, they were reasonable people who were just incredibly misinformed. And there's lots of reasons for that, beyond the fact that, you know, there is a tremendous amount of confirmation bias. If you are inside that sphere and your paycheck is being funded by work that you're doing, you are going to regard all information in a very biased way. Moreover, I would suggest that this was almost like entering a church. And I would begin by saying this: the person who chaired both the opening and closing plenary sessions was Gregory Poland, who is a physician. He's the head of vaccine research at the Mayo Clinic, and he is a skilled orator. I found out later that he is also a pastor, but most importantly, this man has been vaccine injured. And about a year ago, he came forward complaining of tinnitus that followed a second mRNA injection for COVID. And he described it as being extremely bothersome. And he brought together a couple of experts and, you know, went public with it. But nevertheless, he chose to get a booster. And when he opened up this Congress, he was speaking as if he was not injured, because his universal support of the vaccine and the vaccine industry was unmitigated. And he basically sort of threw down exactly the way the church felt about things, if you will. And I don't mean to say church specifically, temple, whatever you want to call it, sort of a way of looking at things, a doctrine, if you will. And that doctrine included the fact that, first, millions of people have died from COVID-19, which, hopefully, we all understand that is a distortion of the truth. We may be able to say that millions of people died with a COVID-19 diagnosis based on a PCR test, but to say that that was the causative factor in their demise is a gross misrepresentation. He also said that the vaccines, the COVID-19 vaccines specifically, were tremendously effective. And lauded the people in the FDA and the CDC, the regulatory agencies, for going beyond the call of duty to make sure that these products were deployed as best as could be done. And then finally, the third point, which I thought was very interesting, was the failure or the challenge at this point right now of the entire system was that there are too many vaccine hesitant people in the population. And that was a, in my mind, it was a thread to pull on, because I went there primarily, I thought, just to survey what the conversations were like and to get some bearing on where the entire juggernaut of the vaccine industry, coupled with the regulatory agencies, which in my mind are in their pocket, where they were headed. But when he offered that as the major challenge, I realized that there was a chance to actually perhaps do more therapeutic interventions than diagnostic tests. In other words, how can we change the narrative? How do we get inside the minds of these people that believe they're doing the right thing? So that was how it opened. And sitting on the panel, in the very opening session, was a number of people in the industry, including not in the industry, but we also had Peter Marks, who is the head of CBER at the FDA, the Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, and who is also a big member of the FDA's VRBPAC, the Vaccine and Related Biologic Products Advisory Committee. And these are the folks that decide whether to approve or authorize an intervention of a vaccine specifically. And, you know, he made some very interesting statements. The first being that he envisions in the future that there will be annual or biannual COVID-19 boosters. He has also said that he has given up on the idea of a sterilizing vaccine. In other words, he's saying that we're never going to be able to make a vaccine against COVID that's going to protect you from infection or transmission. It's merely going to be a matter of a product that will mitigate symptoms of COVID. So in essence, this is just a medical therapy. It is not a preventive measure in his mind. And finally, he made the peculiar and I would say disquieting statement that he is through arguing with people who think that these vaccines are unsafe, which is a disquieting statement from a person who's supposed to be regulating these things. I mean, has he already given up on the fact that there's no room for his understanding to grow? So that's what that's how it opened. And I can stop here for a second, Gary, if you have any questions about that.
No, everything is being laid out very nicely. Please continue.
Mm-hmm. So that led to my first foray into engaging with these folks. And I attended a roundtable that had to do with the question of how do we stop, how do we get to the vaccine hesitant, and how do we stop misinformation from being spread? You know, their idea of misinformation is the spreading of information that has to do with the very real and devastating consequences of these products in some people that's being ignored. And, you know, that's how I see it. But that sort of argument is considered misinformation to that side. And so I sat down, and I happened to be sitting next to Dame Jennifer Margaret Harries, who is the chief executive of the UK HSA. This is the United Kingdom Health Security Agency. Basically, this is an agency that works in the United Kingdom to put out official statistics and data about the population's health. And this organization is very interesting because they were the first ones to break data to the public in September of 2021 that demonstrated that there was a negative efficacy of the vaccine. And, you know, to your listeners, negative efficacy means that if you get vaccinated, you have a greater risk of contracting COVID than if you're unvaccinated. Now, this is should be a stunning, stunning piece of information because, you know, by that time we were all aware of the fact that the potency of the vaccine was waning. So we can all understand how it may not work forever, but why would there be negative efficacy? Why was it opening up a person's physiology to COVID infection? And this, you know, has enormous implications. in terms of is it destroying our immune systems? Is there another process involved? This should be a major, major concern. And this was not just an aberration in the data, because subsequent reports from the UKHSA demonstrated a growing negative efficacy in all age groups. And then 6 months later, they stopped reporting on it. So I was sitting next to her, and I was complimentary to her agency about putting out that data. And I wanted to know, you know, why did they stop reporting it? And shockingly, she looked at me and said, first of all, she was very, very happy to engage until I brought this up. And then things changed. You know, suddenly she said that she was unaware of those numbers, and she would have to get back to me about that, which I thought was peculiar, to say the least, because she took over in April of 2021 of this agency, and this happened in September. So I would imagine that she was well aware of this and probably made the decision to stop reporting it. So at that point, I then brought up Tess Lori, who is a very, very powerful and noted voice in public health. She runs the evidence-based medicine consultancy in the UK. And of note, she wrote an open letter to the United Kingdom's MHRA, which is the equivalent organization of the FDA in the United Kingdom, calling for an immediate halt to all COVID-19 vaccinations based upon the data that was coming from the United Kingdom yellow card system. And the yellow card system is akin to America's VAERS, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, there are doctors in my country that are gaining a lot of fame for their anti-vax positions. In fact, there is a cardiologist right now that's is doing the same thing. And, you know, I'm not sure how much your audience knows, but she was referring to Dr. Asim Malhotra, who is a cardiologist, a very renowned cardiologist in the world, and especially in the United Kingdom. And of course, that was a very peculiar statement because, you know, he was famous before COVID-19. So, you know, where did this come from? And in any case, you know, I typically open this up because the topic had to do with, you know, how do we stop misinformation? And they were asking for advice from the roundtable. And I was the first one to say something. And I always, you know, phrase it like this, which is, to the person who is unable to jump into the data and look at studies and decide how to interpret numbers. And by that, I'm talking about most people. You know, most people will only read a headline or a tweet or hear it from the doctor. They don't go and actually look at studies and challenge the methodology of the researchers. Most people will see two groups who are mirror images of each other, right? You know, if you just take out the data and take out the science, you have two groups that are screaming that the other side is listening to misinformation, that the other side is not only misinformed, but their decisions are hurting the public. Both sides think that the other side is incredibly gullible, right? I mean, that's exactly, both sides look exactly like each other to the person who doesn't know what the data shows. So how are they going to decide who to believe? The difference is that one side is pleading for a debate. You know, can we come together and talk about our differences so we can come to a resolution, an agreement, or a consensus? Yet the other side wants censorship of the other side, right? The other side wants to shut down any discussion. And my point was, how on earth would we ever expect the side that's asking for censorship to be believed? It doesn't make any sense. So the obvious solution is to engage them. You know, don't bring in the layperson straw man argument, you know, who says that they know somebody who was vaccine injured and therefore they're not going to get, you know, the vaccine. You know, that's typically how the mainstream media will attack the vaccine cautionary sphere. They'll bring in that kind of person. And I was saying, why don't you bring in the experts? Why don't you bring in the physicians who have treated thousands of patients successfully, the ones who have not only read the literature, but contribute to the vast body of literature on this, people who have published peer-reviewed papers, the actual spokespeople of the vaccine cautionary movement. Why don't you bring them in and have it out with them publicly? And if you're so confident in your position, dismantle their arguments. Because the people who remain unvaccinated and remain skeptical of this technology are not the ones that took the carrot and stick. You know, they're not going to be swayed by more Krispy Kreme donuts or threats to their ability to travel. You know, these are the ones that are very, very sure of their position. And immediately, my comments were followed by another comment from a very interesting person that I got to know a little bit more over the next 3 days. Her name is Katie Atwell, and she's a professor from the University of Western Australia. And she's a behavioral scientist, and she has received a lot of funding to deal with vaccine hesitancy. And she immediately said that that would be a mistake, because in her experience, if you give equal footing to the opposition, the public will believe that they have a legitimate position. And then the discussion went on from there. I'm going to stop there again, Gary. Is there anything else you want me to say about that?
You were the token advocate for a more open dialogue in what seems to be a vaccine star chamber. Mm-hmm. The whole purpose is, how can we convince people through propaganda, through government mandate, through restrictions, through personal attacks, using the platform, the mainstream media, which now has been shown because of Elon Musk buying Twitter and because of all the testimony that's come out under oath by the people who worked at Twitter, including over a dozen FBI agents, that virtually every major platform, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Wikipedia in particular, these are influenced directly by special interest groups, but not the public, not the advocates for an open dialogue. These people have the intent, meaning with malfeasance and malice, they want to destroy any credibility in a counter-argument. As I said at the beginning, the world has been told there's only one truth, and then this truth has become ordained as the only gospel you should be accepting. And it's almost become like a religious cult. The entirety of the scientific community, except for those who've been brave enough not to join and to have some different opinion. But where do they take their opinion? Where do you take your opinion? To a group that immediately, where you're saying we should have open discussion and not suppression of freedom of speech, the person who's receiving money says, who's an official advocate, mind you, she represents the Australian government, and the Australian government represents the kind of unified field of orthodoxy on COVID. So you're that tiny little speck of light in a gigantic universe of darkness, and you're right. Supposed to be heard, and they're not hearing you. They're attacking you. There's no open dialogue when someone says, no, that's dangerous. Well, how did you come to the decision it was dangerous? Let me ask you this, to go a little further in this, if you don't mind, please.
Please.
I'm going to throw up some issues and tell me if these are reasonable or not, because I, on my side, I have the scientific evidence in abundance on each thing I'm going to say. Not a single one of these arguments have been allowed in any of the media or government discussions. And a couple of scientists at the FDA who were on the advisory panels who tried raising similar issues quit. Now, we don't know if they voluntarily quit or they were forced to quit. So once again, they have only one voice. Now, let's go through them, because these are the main ones, and I'll make them quick. The only way we could know if we had a epidemic or pandemic would be if we had a test that would determine the accuracy of a diagnosis, and that was the PCR test. The trouble is, the person who got the Nobel Prize, Dr. Carey Mullis, was a professional friend of mine. In fact, I had the longest interview ever done with him. I did many interviews, and I filmed this out in California, an hour and 54 minutes, where he said Fauci didn't know what he was talking about. He was an idiot. He talked about people misusing the test. And if you misuse the test, it's worthless and dangerous. If you use it correctly, meaning 13 cycles or repetitions, and the maximum 16. If you go beyond that, he said you're dealing in non-differentiated material, meaning you can't tell what you've got, a live virus, a dead virus, a part of a virus. And what was the, even Fauci said, I believe it was 24 cycles. And what did we use? What did everyone walking in and driving in and getting that nasal swab get? 40 to 44 cycles. So it was completely useless, meaning the very diagnostic tool we were using was going to give you the vast majority of false positives. Then in comes stage two. The New York Times starts saying these are cases. But as a physician, you know a case has to manifest some symptom to differentiate from normal. And some people had no symptoms at all. And those who had robust immune systems, who were younger, who had no comorbidities, they were testing positive, but we were told, oh, that's because you can spread the disease just as easily if you are asymptomatic or if you're highly symptomatic. And then people were saying, well, immunologists saying, no, that's not the way immunology works. And they were not counting upon any natural immunity. Then we were told you need herd immunity. So if about the number went up, it was 63, 68, 72, 77, 82% were infected, then we would have herd immunity. Then suddenly when people were told that they had herd immunity and we met the statistics to prove herd immunity, they said herd immunity doesn't count anymore. It's only vaccine herd immunity. So when enough people get vaccinated and then we had a shortage, so everybody rushed. The idea was we're running out of vaccines, so people would do anything to get their vaccines. Then we were told, well, you got to get multiple vaccines because these will prevent you from infecting other people. So people believe this. And then we're seeing a phenomenon in hospitals, people coming into the hospitals and being treated in a way that would more likely lead to their death rather than their survival. And we were told, go home, stay there until your lips turn blue and you have to be rushed to the ICU. And not to do anything else. But we had people who were older, who had comorbidities, and who were infected. But then we had, interesting, all over Europe, in Gibraltar, in Norway, in Sweden, and in Spain, we had nursing homes that had zero COVID. Older patients, they all had comorbidities. They were forced to get vaccinated against their will, and suddenly they all had COVID, which meant that the vaccine was actually causing COVID. Let me repeat that. The vaccine was a primary cause of COVID in people who had multiple comorbidities, the most common being obesity, diabetes, emphysema from smoking more often than not, and dementia. And there were others, but those were the primary ones. And we were told, no, those don't count, meaning if you test positive for COVID, which 95% of people would, and it'd be a false positive, you died of COVID. So we didn't even have the honesty to say the death from COVID is not the same as death from the other conditions, including in hospice care where everyone was there, for example, with a life-ending disease, mainly cancer. So you were in your last days or weeks of life with an advanced cancer that was medically no longer treatable. And if you tested positive for COVID, then you died of COVID. Then we had hospitals charging people by changing the diagnosis and changing the treatment so they could benefit for up to $100,000 per patient as long as it was COVID. And then we had morticians saying people were coming in and we saw the death certificate, a motorcycle accident in one case of a young kid. It was COVID death. So everybody was milking the system. And anyone with an IQ above 7 would have seen this enormous medical fraud occurring, but everyone was on board. And in fact, the head of the largest healthcare insurance company in the United States received over $79 million bonus or salary that year. So a massive amount of money was made after COVID. But it was people who were in the system. But then no article could be written that challenged any part of this narrative. So then we were told, wear masks. There were two masks. Wear three masks. But every single study, and I have 62 studies, and not including the latest one from the Cochrane group, showed there was no difference. To the contrary, different masks can, if you wash them, will throw off the fibers. The fibers connect in your lungs and can cause a fibrosis condition. But no one even talked about that. A plastic shield covering your whole face, where you could still breathe and get out the carbon dioxide, that wasn't advocated, just the masks. But the virus can infect your eyes, but nobody covered the eyes. And then there were two studies showing children with masks using every type of mask, and one showed alarms going off, a beeper going off, the moment they were oxygen deprived, where they weren't at 20 to 21% oxygen, they were down 19%. And yet that's the same mask that kids were wearing all day, including on soccer fields. Then we had another study showing kids having a carbon dioxide buildup to where it was dangerous. And again, nobody said a thing. Nobody said a warning. And then we were told no medicine works, especially ivermectin. So I decided to go in because I'm also a scientist and a senior research fellow for 38 years at the Institute of Applied Biology and the director of their anti-aging department, and published in peer-reviewed journals, done 55 clinical studies, including the most important anti-aging study ever done, and just finished it, showing we added 2.2 years to an average person's lifespan if they followed the protocols. But that's beside the point. It means that at least I know, having taught research methodology, how to read a study. But the average scientist, for some reason, wasn't reading the studies. If they had read the studies, they would have asked, okay, we're being told it's just horse paste, this ivermectin. It's crap. You don't want to take it. It's toxic. I looked at all the literature, and I published that there were over 227 studies at that time, including some good quality studies showing this. And countries that used ivermectin, which was called the Sunday-to-Sunday drug in Africa, for malaria prevention and schistosomiasis prevention and hydroxychloroquine, the same, I found drugs. Put them together, we had over 500 studies, and they're saying no study exists. Well, how, with all the resources that you have of all governmental agencies and all the networks having all that resource, how is it you couldn't find that I found in under 2 hours 500 studies? Now it's up to over 800 studies. And then they attacked Dr. Roche and others at Yale. Anyone who promoted this as having saved lives, they were destroyed. The front page New York Times, Dr. Malone, was destroyed. So virtually every single argument they've given is wrong and is provably, demonstrably wrong. All you have to do is be open enough to look for the evidence, and everything falls apart, because if they don't have the cases, because they don't have an accurate test, then you don't have a pandemic, you don't have an epidemic. Your thoughts, please.
I would agree with everything you said there. You know, you hit a lot of points that were all very salient, and they're correct. And I also have to say something here, which is, you know, look, the highest court in the land is the court of public opinion. And I feel that it's incumbent upon us to educate the public. And I feel like we're at a point right now where we have come to understand that we can't really trust anybody. And the only solution to that is to educate ourselves. So, for example, when you let's talk about PCR testing, for example. That's a really big issue, because they can magnify or minimize not only the infection rates by adjusting the cycle threshold, and they can also basically change the statistics that prove efficacy by changing the cycle threshold. So, you know, we say these things, but how is the listener going to interpret that? Like, do they just have to believe us, believe you and believe me? How do they know what to believe? So, like, with regard to PCR, for example, and I always talk about it in a way that hopefully will be sensical and logical, and you don't need to have a tremendous amount of mathematical background or, you know, be an expert in PCR to understand this. But here's the thing. Like, let's say we have a diagnostic test. Forget about PCR, for example, just a diagnostic test, which is 90% accurate, which is a pretty good test. In other words, if you test 10 people or let's say 100 people that actually have the disease, this test will return a positive result in 90 of them. It will return a negative test result in 10 of them. So when we look at, say, a population that has an incidence of disease where only 1 in 10 people have it, and you test 100 people, that means, you know, you're looking at a group of 100 people, 90 people don't have it, 10 people do, and you apply this test. What is it going to show us? Well, it's going to give you 9 positive results out of the 10 people who have it, right? But it'll also return 9 positive results in the 90 people that don't have it, okay? So this is where, you know, this is something that's somehow lost on physicians. I don't know why, but like, we're supposed to learn about this. But the point here is that you test 100 people in this population with the incidence of disease being 10%, and 1/2 of the positive results will be false positives. And the point I'm trying to make here is to logically present what the problem is when we start testing people in a population where the incidence is low and your suspicion of the disease is also low. The point being is, if you start testing, you know, willy-nilly asymptomatic people, people who just got back from vacation, people who want to go to summer camp, that's what we were doing. We were testing people with a very low suspicion of disease. You are going to magnify the incidence of false positives. So, you know, that's just the point here, is to go a little bit deeper than telling people that's how it works. This is how it works. This is why that was a major problem. And as we know, you probably know this already, Gary, is that, you know, prior to the vaccine, the cycle thresholds, you know, were through the roof. So we were overdiagnosing disease. But then when the CDC was looking at breakthrough infections, they were only looking at people who tested positive. By breakthrough, I'm talking about people who got the infection after being vaccinated. They were only looking at people who tested positive with very low cycle thresholds. So they have biased their decision-making based on the cycle threshold. This would minimize the number of breakthrough infections because you're testing with the lower cycle threshold. So, I mean, this is like, you know, basic mathematics, and you can see how the distortion occurs. So here's another point, right? We're talking about masks, which is another enormous topic. A lot of people, you know, for some reason, a few months ago, I was outside in a parking lot, and there was a person standing there by themselves with a mask on, and they pulled down their mask to light a cigarette. And, you know, like, what are you supposed to do with that, right? You know, it's obvious that this person has been programmed into thinking that, you know, this mask is going to be useful, yet we'll still smoke a cigarette. So the point here is that we have been programmed, and it's not easy to undo that kind of programming. And when we talk about masks, you know, your point is excellent. I feel like it doesn't matter how many studies demonstrate that masks really have no bearing on the transmission of disease. And look, we also have to talk about what kind of masks are you talking about? You know, I'm an anesthesiologist. I've been in the operating room for, you know, most of my adult life, 40 hours a week. I've worn a mask for, you know, 20,000 hours. And we do it not because somebody thinks it's probably a good idea. There's lots of literature that talk about what surgical masks can and cannot do. In some Western countries, anesthesia providers don't wear masks in the operating room. But there we're talking about preventing surgical site infections. That's why people wear masks in the operating room. It's not to prevent a respiratory-borne illness. And, you know, doctors should know this. You know, the first time we walk into an operating room as a medical student, the nurse comes up to us, you know, looks us, you know, head to toe and, you know, right in the eye and says, look, 2 rules here, young doctor. Number 1, don't touch anything. Number 2, if you have to sneeze or cough, don't look away from the patient. You cough directly at the patient or the surgical site if you're holding a retractor or something. The reason is that when you turn your head, everything that you just expelled goes out the sides of the mask. So the point here is that we should know commonsensically that wearing a flimsy surgical mask outside or anywhere else is not going to do anything. You know, in the operating room, when we're taking care of a someone with an active pulmonary infection, let's say TB, we take our masks off, you know, and we put on N95 custom fit respirators and we turn on negative pressure in the operating room. That works. Wearing a surgical mask doesn't. I mean, like, physicians should know this, yet they don't. And the point here is that there's so many studies that demonstrate if there is an effect, it's barely measurable. But we have an enormous amount of evidence that demonstrates that chronic mask wearing use is detrimental to your health, you know, from your anxiety to people who have diminished pulmonary reserve. I mean, if you're the mother of a child with asthma, when they're having an attack, what's the first thing you're going to do? You're going to take off their mask, right? It doesn't matter how many studies you can show this mother that say that, you know, masks don't prevent the exchange of air. It does. Like, you know, I mean, it's peculiar. I don't know, Gary, you hit so many points there. I just wanted to throw that in there. Anything else?
I have one last one, please. Mm-hmm. This moves into trying to understand the mindset, the mentality of professional conformity. Of course, this is something I have faced my entire adult life since I first started advocating for natural health over 56 years ago. Mm-hmm. It has always been a struggle between beliefs around subjective interpretation of research and scientific evidence. Then interpretations become rigid ideologies. So now there is an enormous body of literature and medical experts warning about the dangers of these COVID vaccines. And one thing seems certain is that those who are now criticizing the studies supporting their efficacy, safety, and immunity claims are growing. And that means the numbers of those who blindly accept whatever the federal health agencies and private vaccine companies say is decreasing. So how do you account for this? And you may wish to share your own personal epiphany during your medical practice that made you realize that a lot of the modern medical practices, even in your discipline of anesthesiology, is based more on belief and faith than on sound empirical evidence. Of a shorter answer, please, because we only have about 3.5 to 4 minutes left in our program.
Well, that's a big question. I'll be as brief as I can. First of all, I would have to say that most physicians are willing to look at literature that have to do with their field. Anesthesiologists look at anesthesia literature and pediatricians look at pediatric literature. So very few physicians actually refer to the CDC for anything, right? We've never been in a pandemic, you know, unless you're 105 years old in this country. And this was a unprecedented time for physicians. Very rarely have we had to go and say, oh my gosh, what do we do? Let's ask the CDC. Normally we ask our own specialty boards about what the current guidance is. So it's not unreasonable to think that most physicians did not know how to critique or rebut what was coming from the CDC. We just don't know. And it made sense to follow their lead. That's the first thing. Secondly, you know, I came into medical school as an engineer with, you know, a modest background in mathematics and computational studies. And what I found very early on was that my colleagues in medical school didn't know how to do these things. And this translated later on in our life when we start reviewing literature that has to do with data. And most physicians don't know how to read a study, or let alone critique the methodology that the authors use. So there is a deficit amongst us in terms of assessing information, which I believe is what you're getting to. But in my particular field of anesthesia, that's where, you know, it was even more striking because, you know, anesthetic gases like ether, for example, or desflurane and sevoflurane, the inhaled agents that we use, they're some of the oldest medicines in that we use. And we have no idea what the mechanism is. And for some reason, my colleagues in anesthesia, you know, shrug it off as like, someday we'll figure it out, but we don't know now. But if you really take a deeper look at the problem we have and the way we frame it in terms of finding a mechanism, we are never going to come up with the right answer. And that is one of the fundamental chapters in my book, Woke and Anesthesiologist View, because in my experience, consciousness and awareness is non-local, and it's primary. In my mind, it does not come about because of molecular interactions. And, you know, this is something obviously for another conversation, but it profoundly changes the way I look at the world when I realize that awareness itself is probably and most likely not a function of a functioning body. So,
good.
You know,
there are a lot of implications there. Let's hold it right there, and here's why. I'm going to invite you back for another hour to talk about something that is in your book and that we did not have a chance today to get into, and that is we are now living in a new dark age of intellect. Yep. And as a result, our so-called Western civilization is infused with confusion, contradiction, expert speaking and oxymorons, rampant self-centeredness, division, and anger. And we have to take a look at something beyond that which is physical, something that does not die when the body dies and was born before the body was born. That will be our next discussion if you're up for it.
Amen.
All right. I look forward to that conversation. Richard Gale, our executive producer, will call you later today and we'll get set and probably hopefully get this recorded so it'll be on next week. My guest on today's Progressive Commentary Hour, Dr. Madhava Sethi, and he is really leading a whole new mindset among those physicians willing to challenge the existing status quo. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.